Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff, and welcome to the Bokomi podcast, Original Memorable Insights, or OMI, from the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode, we meet the former rocket scientist who wants you to simplify your thinking to shoot for the moon.
When we succeed, there's a faulty assumption that follows, that everything went according to plan, right? We made all the right decisions, we made all the right calls, and that's why we succeeded, but we discount the role that luck and privilege and opportunity play in producing success. Because it's possible to make a bad decision and still succeed.
Ozan Varol studied astrophysics at Cornell University and then served on the 2003 Mars exploration project, launching a new career as a law professor and a much sought after contributor and writer for the BBC, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and many more. Today, he blogs to millions at ozanvarol.com. His new book, Think Like a Rocket Scientist, Simple Strategies You Can Use to Make Giant Leaps in Work and Life, is Adam Grant's number one pick for 2020 and is on Bokomi's most wanted list for May. Ozan, welcome to Bokomi.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Anyone who references Bon Jovi, Aristotle, Apollo 13, Spinal Tap, Walt Whitman, and The Simpsons in one book has got my vote. Why do you think it's important? Why do you think it's important for experts in one field, such as rocket science or law, to have a variety of divergent reference points for their thinking?
Well, that's where original ideas come from. Ideas, original ideas, creative ideas, are actually combinations of existing ideas from different disciplines. And that's true for scientific breakthroughs as much as it is for business breakthroughs. One of my favorite examples of this is the founding of Netflix. So Reed Hastings, this was back in the day when you actually had to walk into a video store like Blockbuster, physically go in and look at DVDs and pick something up and leave. He had incurred a bunch of late fees for renting Apollo 13, which is one of my all-time favorite movies. He misplaced the movie. He eventually found it. And he's, you know, he was pissed off about having to pay $50 in late fees. And so he drops off the movie at his local Blockbuster and he goes to his gym to work out. And as he's working out, he arrives at an epiphany. He thinks to himself and says, well, at the gym, I pay $30 a month and I can work out as much or as little as I want. Why don't we do the same thing with videos? Why don't we create a model where you're not depending on a physical store, but you're also not having to pay late fees. You're paying a fixed fee every month to rent as many movies or as little movies as you want. And that was the seed that eventually blossomed into Netflix. I mean, it's so obvious in hindsight, but a lot of creative ideas are obvious only in hindsight. And in this case, they began with the adoption of this idea from the fitness industry and putting it into the video rental industry. But there are so many other examples of this. Like another one of my favorites, which I talk about in the book, is from Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin was inspired by a geology textbook and an economics textbook in creating the Origin of Species. In the geology textbook, he was reading about how these changes that we're seeing on the Earth's surface, on the Earth's structure, happened over eons, over really long periods of time, as wind, erosion, and water slowly chipped away at the Earth's surface. And he thought to himself, oh, I wonder if that's true for species as well, whether the products that we're seeing right now are actually as a result of minor changes that have happened over hundreds of thousands of years. And then he also took an idea from economics. He read an economics textbook which argued that populations tend to outgrow resources for survival, creating this competition for survival. And the economics textbook said the strongest survive. And Darwin took that idea and applied it to biology. Now in Darwin's time, there were people who read that geology textbook. There were people who read that economics textbook. But it was the rare person who read a geology textbook, who read the economics textbook, who also studied species, and who could apply those ideas and combine them to create one of the, you know, the most revolutionary scientific breakthroughs of our time.
It's such a broad range of reference points you've got there, but how do we apply that to our day-to-day lives? So we've all got brains. Is it something about the brain that is wired to think in only one way? Surely, if we're all capable of thinking like Darwin or a rocket scientist or Reed Hastings, why don't all our brains default in that direction?
Well, there are two things that we don't do. One is we tend to stick to what we know. So if you are an electrical engineer, you read only about electrical engineering. Or if you are a biologist, you read only about biology. People rarely look to other fields and try to learn something that they... This especially is true for later in our lives when we're being specialized and working on one thing. It becomes really hard to see what other industries are doing because we don't learn about them. So we don't actually try to pick up a textbook on something we know nothing about, or pick up a magazine on a subject that we know nothing about and actually learn about it. So before you can make these connections between the dots, you have to collect the dots. And collecting the dots means exposing yourself to different ways of thinking, to different industries and areas that you know nothing about. So that's step number one. Step number two about why our brains don't default to this setting of combination is because we don't let our brains do that. We don't let our brains do that because we fill every minute of our days with activity. We jump from one notification to the next, one email to the next, one Zoom meeting to the next, and we don't give our brains to time and space to connect the dots. In the book, I call this getting bored. Such a foreign concept to many of us these days, but getting bored simply means spending unstructured periods of time free of distractions. And boredom is absolutely essential to creativity, to allowing your, because when you're bored, what happens is, and when you're daydreaming, for example, what's called the default mode network in your brain comes alive. And that the default mode network is associated with creativity. And what happens is your brain, your subconscious, begins making these connections between the dots that you collected, which is why, you know, so many epiphanies happen in the shower, right? When you're not distracted, when so many epiphanies happen when you're taking a long walk. There's so many stories of scientists literally walking into the solution of a problem that they're struggling with. In the case of Einstein, it was playing the violin. But we don't give our brains the time to actually step away from a problem and let it connect the dots. There's a saying that I love. It's the silence in between the notes that makes the music. And it's true for our day-to-day lives as well. You need to be very intentional about building that silence into your day. Otherwise, your creativity will suffer. So in my own life, you know, one of the crazy things I do is I'll spend 20 minutes a day in the sauna with nothing but a notepad and a pencil. And some of the best ideas in recent memory occur to me in that solitary, stifling environment. And it can just be, you know, as simple as sort of building in an airplane mode into your day when you're sitting 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes doing nothing but thinking. And it's amazing what can happen as a result.
Well, I hope you haven't dribbled all over your notepad and ruined all those brilliant ideas. That's what's called sweating for your work.
Which is why I use a pencil. I know, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, that's a very smart, astute thing to do anyway, isn't it? To use the pencil instead of the biro. That's an apocryphal tale, isn't it? You obviously have what the astronomer Chris Impey, who I'm not sure if you know his work, is the author of Beyond Our Future in Space. What he calls the explorer gene. You've obviously got that aplenty. So growing up in Turkey, how did you know you wanted to be a rocket scientist?
So we were living in this small apartment in Istanbul, and we would get blackouts really frequently, which when I was 4 or 5 years old just absolutely terrified me. And my dad came up with this game. He would grab my soccer ball and he would light a candle, and he would rotate the soccer ball around the candle, and that to illustrate basically how the Earth rotated around the sun. And those were my very first astronomy lessons, and I was hooked from the get-go. One of the other things that inspired me to keep moving in the direction of astrophysics and rocket science was my love for science fiction. Isaac Asimov, for example, was one of my favorite authors growing up. Arthur C. Clarke, Ray Bradbury. I would just, buy all of their books that I could afford and just read endless amounts of science fiction and dream about going to space. And it also became for me an escape from the very conformist education system that existed in Turkey. I mean, I love the country of Turkey. My parents still live there. But the education system was very, very conformist. Conformity exists, I think, across education systems across the globe, but it was really entrenched into the Turkish education system. I tell the story in the book about how our school principal would in primary school. We would get these numbers assigned to us. So, like, you were 154 or 358. And the principal and some of our teachers would call us by that number, not by our name. It was a very much a way of stripping down individuality and enforcing conformity. And that trumped everything else. So, if you're a creative, a contrarian, a trailblazer, you did not get ahead. And so for me, rocket science, reading science fiction, dreaming about space became an escape from that, from the very conformist education system and led me eventually to apply to college in the United States and come over here 20 years ago to study astrophysics.
And it must have been quite strange for you landing here and starting here. I mean, you described yourself very modestly as a slightly uncool teenager with a love of soft rock. Did you embrace what essentially is a very different culture and change as a person?
I did, and I definitely struggled quite a bit because I was very different from everybody else around me. I had a very thick accent. I had this funny name. I was from a country halfway around the globe, and I had esoteric interests like computer programming that didn't make me all that popular. And so I struggled with fitting in and belonging. And I always thought, to be able to belong, you have to fit in. In other words, you adjust your preferences. And I became a really keen observer of people. I almost applied like the scientific method to the physics of society. I would observe people around me, see how they thought, see how they acted, and I would adjust my behavior accordingly. And I became really, really good at fitting in. But I realized later in life that actually was not serving me well. I became very good at empathy and I became very good at seeing different perspectives, but I was also betraying who I was by basically conforming to what was expected of me, or what I thought was expected of me for me to be able to survive in this very new environment that I was operating in. And Brené Brown talks about this in one of her books beautifully, but she writes about how fitting in gets in the way of belonging. Fitting in is a way of betraying who you are, and it becomes an obstacle to belonging, even though we think the opposite happens. Belonging it happens when you bring your own authentic self to the rest of the world, and you feel accepted for who you are, not for the curated portrayal that you put out into the world. And it took me a very long time to learn that lesson.
You found your authentic self, probably in its purest and most exciting form, when you got onto the team of the 2003 Mars Exploration Project. What was that like? That must have been like a kid winning the Willy Wonka prize, the golden ticket.
Absolutely. I love the Willy Wonka reference. I was sitting in my, and I distinctly remember this moment, 2 weeks before I arrived at Cornell for my first year. I was, a high school senior in Turkey, and I was researching what the astronomy department at Cornell was up to. And I learned that one of the professors at Cornell, his name is Steve Squires, was in charge of this project, a planned mission to Mars to send a rover to Mars. And he was also had been a graduate student under Carl Sagan, and Carl Sagan was one of my just childhood heroes. I watched the original Cosmos series on old Betamax tapes, even when I didn't know what Carl Sagan was talking about, and that wasn't speaking a word of English at the time. But so I wrote an email to Steve Squires. There was no job listing, just expressing my burning desire to work for him. And I remember sitting in that apartment and looking at the email. I was about to hit send, and then this voice came into my head. And the voice simply said, "You don't know what you're doing. You're a skinny kid with a funny name from a country halfway around the globe. What could you possibly contribute?" And I took a deep breath and I asked myself two questions. One is, what's the worst that can happen? And the worst that can happen is he never responds to my email and I never hear from him again. And what's the best that can happen? Well, what's the best that can happen is I'm Willy Wonka and I get to go to the chocolate factory. I get to have this amazing job that I was dreaming about. And that those two questions, especially the second one, of course, what's the best that can happen, inspired me to click send. And Steve invited me in for an interview. And I had taught myself how to do computer programming in high school. And that proved to be critical to what he was looking for. And he ended up offering me the job on the operations team of what would become the 2003 Mars Exploration Rovers mission. And so we did everything from design operation scenarios to help pick landing sites to my senior thesis was programming software that the rover's cameras would use to take photos of the Martian surface. So it was just, going from daydreaming about space in my small apartment, my small room in Turkey, to actually having the front row seats to the action. It was just absolutely incredible.
One of the people on the planet who pursued their dreams in this direction to the nth or the X degree is Elon Musk. You talk about Elon Musk about a lot in the book and his SpaceX project. What do you think people can learn from the way he approaches a problem? Can it be applied to everyday life?
Absolutely. So Elon Musk, he is very good at first principles thinking. And that's one of the chapters in my book. But the basic idea, let me actually illustrate that with a story of how he started SpaceX. So he sold PayPal to eBay and walked away with a bunch of money. And his next venture, he decided, was going to be an aerospace company. He wanted to launch a rocket and send humans to Mars. And he did what other people might do, which is to begin shopping for rockets. He first was shopping for them on the American market, and they turned out to be way too expensive. He went to Russia to shop for, I kid you not, decommissioned intercontinental ballistic missiles without the nuclear warheads on top, of course. And even those turned out to be really expensive. And he was coming back from a flight from Russia, empty-handed, and he had an epiphany. And he arrived at that epiphany using first principles thinking. So first principles thinking is a way of looking at a system and breaking it down to its fundamental non-negotiable subcomponents, the raw materials. Everything else is negotiable. It's like hacking through a jungle with a machete, just getting rid of all of the assumptions until you distill a system down to its non-negotiable foundations. The example I give in the book is like you go from being a cover band who plays somebody else's songs to being an original artist who does the painstaking work of looking at the raw materials, the raw ingredients, the musical notes, and creating an original song. So for Elon Musk, that meant asking himself, instead of buying rockets that other people have built, what does it actually take to put a rocket into space? Like, what are the raw materials, the fundamental subcomponents of a rocket? And it turned out that if you bought those raw materials on the market and built the rockets from scratch yourself, it was like 2% of the typical price of a rocket, which is a crazy ratio. And so he said, all right, I'll just start my own space company and build these next generation rockets from scratch, which is exactly what he did. And first principles thinking led him to question another deeply held assumption in rocket science. And that assumption is that rockets cannot be reused. So for decades, rockets, after they took their payload into orbit, would burn up in the atmosphere or plunge into the ocean, and they couldn't be reused again. Now imagine for a moment doing the same thing with commercial flights, right? You fly from New York to London, people get off the plane, somebody steps up to the plane and just torches it. Sounds crazy, but that's basically what we did for rockets for decades. And by the way, the price of a modern rocket is about the same as a Boeing 737, but commercial flight is so much cheaper because airplanes can be reused quickly over and over and over again. So Elon Musk, along with Jeff Bezos and his space company Blue Origin, decided to question that fundamental assumption in rocket science and said, well, what if we built reusable rockets that can be reused completely and quickly? And so now, when you look at Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, there is a landing pad next to a launching pad. That's a new thing in rocket science. So many of the rocket stages that SpaceX and Blue Origin have sent into space have come back, and they have been recovered and refurbished and sent back into outer space like certified pre-owned vehicles. And so that's how first principles thinking produced really two breakthroughs from in Elon Musk's world. And that same principle can also lead to breakthroughs in your own life or work. A lot of us are operating under outdated assumptions. We're too stuck with the status quo, and we are not doing enough to question those assumptions. And we're recording this interview at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, where the entire world has been forced out of the status quo. And so if you are privileged enough to be healthy and safe, it's a great time to be questioning some of the assumptions that you're operating under. Ask yourself, why am I doing what I'm doing? Would I be doing the same thing that I'm doing today if this process, this routine, this habit hadn't been adopted a year ago, or 5 years ago, or 10 years ago? It's also really helpful to bring in outsiders into the conversation. So a lot of us don't see the outdated assumptions that we're operating in because we're too close to the problem to think differently. And so the outsiders have an advantage because they don't know anything about the conventional wisdom in your field. They don't know anything about the status quo. And so they can see what you're missing, which is why so many of the trailblazers, going back to Elon Musk, have been outsiders. So Elon Musk came in from Silicon Valley. He knew very little about rocket science. He learned it by reading books, textbooks. Jeff Bezos started Amazon. He came from the finance world. Reed Hastings was the software developer before he started Netflix. And they were able to see a lot of the outdated structures and assumptions that the insiders to the industry were missing. And this doesn't mean, by the way, that you hire an outside consultant or an outside expensive outside speaker. It can be as simple as bringing in a different team member, so a member of a different team or a different division into the conversation and letting them ask what we pejoratively call those dumb questions that are actually not dumb at all, because they go to some fundamental aspect of the problem that you are missing. And amateurs are really good at asking those questions. So it can be as simple as, again, asking your a team member or even your spouse to come in and give yourself input on what you're working on. And the results are often revolutionary.
Do you think that's what we should do or should be being done with the pandemic? That the teams of scientists and epidemiologists and experts in the field of viruses, coronavirus, do you think they should be inviting experts from other fields, rocket scientists, business leaders, computer programmers, to ask dumb questions about the pandemic spread?
Absolutely. And don't get me wrong, expertise is really, really valuable. But my point is more limited. Experts should not work in isolation. They also benefit from input from outsiders. And absolutely. So allowing experts from different fields to come in, not only will they be able to ask those dumb questions, but going back to what we were talking about before with connecting ideas from different disciplines, when you've got a number of people in a room who are all experts in their own fields, however different those fields might be, that's when breakthrough ideas are generated. And yeah, so I do think that would be valuable.
So let's talk about success. You quote among many others, George Bernard Shaw, who said, "Science becomes dangerous only when it imagines it's reached its goal." Do you think the same applies to leaders when they think they've made it in life, that they stop learning? And if so, who do you think is the greatest living example of a leader who appears to have stopped learning, and the greatest living example of a leader who appears to have continued learning?
Great questions. I do think that. I do think that success, it's often harder for a business to survive its own success than to survive its failure. Because the moment we think we made it is the moment we stop learning and growing. The moment we declare ourselves to be the leader in something, we stop listening. We start blaming other people when things go wrong. The moment we declare ourselves to be an expert, we stop gathering all the facts necessary to change our minds. And so success can very much get in the way of learning, because when we succeed, there's a faulty assumption that follows, that everything went according to plan, right? We made all the right decisions, we made all the right calls, and that's why we succeeded. But we discount the role that luck and privilege and opportunity play in producing success, because it's possible to make a bad decision and still succeed. But if we're not looking back at our successes and asking ourselves not only what went right with the success, but what went wrong with the success? What was a near miss? What was a bad risk that we took, or a bad decision we made, or a mistake that we made? And how can we learn from that? People tend to ask those questions only after catastrophic failures, but we need to ask them after successes as well. So in the book, the chapter is called Nothing Fails Like Success. I tell the story, and so this goes to one of the questions you asked, Richard, about sort of what institution might be an example that hasn't learned from success. And I would say during the space shuttle era, that would be NASA. So with the Challenger and Columbia space shuttle disasters, both of those followed a string of successes. For the Challenger mission, the technical flaw was in what's called the O-rings. These are flexible rings that seal the joints of the solid rocket boosters that are responsible for launching the spacecraft, and the sealing prevents hot gases from escaping. Now, NASA, before 1986, when the Challenger disaster happened, had been flying space shuttles with damaged O-rings, eroded O-rings, for years. And there are two O-rings on each joint for good measure. There's a primary and a secondary. And on a number of missions, the primary had failed, and the secondary had barely kicked in to save the day. There were a number of engineers who raised their hands and said, and this one engineer, his name is Roger Bourgelet, just 6 months before the Challenger disaster, he wrote a memo and he said, if we don't do something about this problem, the outcome will be a catastrophe of the highest order. I'm talking about a loss of life. But his memo was ignored. And it was ignored because from NASA's perspective, all of these previous shuttle missions that ended up with damaged O-rings were successes. Nothing bad happened. The outcome wasn't compromised. And from the manager's perspective, they said, well, as long as we do what we did yesterday, as long as we follow the same process that led to this previous success, we're going to be okay. And that turned out to be a faulty assumption. And then you fast forward 17 years, you get to 2003, and the Columbia disaster, space shuttle disaster, the technical flaw was different, but the underlying cultural flaw was the same. NASA didn't just have an O-ring problem. NASA also had a conformity problem. NASA also had a complacency problem. And if you're not digging deeper into the second, third order causes of an action, if you're just looking at the surface technical flaw, you might fix the technical flaw, but you're going to leave the underlying conformity flaw, the complacency flaw, those less sexy, deeper causes intact. And that's exactly what happened. In the words of Sally Ride, an astronaut who served at the investigation commission for both of those accidents, you could hear the echoes of Challenger in Colombia. In Colombia, very similar thing happened. The technical flaw was different, but the cultural flaw, the engineers raised their hands and warned management, saying, this big piece of foam separated from the shuttle and struck the thermal insulation on takeoff. We need to do something about the problem while the space shuttle is in orbit. But the manager said, look, we've had foam shedding before. We've had foam strikes before. Nothing bad happened as a result. So we're just going to keep doing business as usual, right? Steady as she goes until you hit an iceberg. So just because you're in a hot streak doesn't mean you'll beat the house. The second part of your question, Richard, was, well, what leader is good at learning from their success? And the first name that popped to mind just goes back to what we were talking about before, and that's Reed Hastings. I think Netflix has been, at least so far, very good at disrupting itself and seeing the writing on the wall before the world around it brings disruption to them, so to speak. So they made the switch from, you know, mailing DVDs in the mail to streaming really fast. They could see the writing on the wall, and they stayed ahead of the melt on the ice cream cone, so to speak. And then they also made the leap from streaming content that was developed by these big studios in Hollywood to generating original content. And they have been just a step ahead of everybody else, because I think they're very good at thinking through and asking themselves, what can we learn from our successes? And to Hastings, actually, I heard him talk about this before. He's not happy if they have a too high of a success ratio with the shows that they're developing. From his perspective, that means they're not taking enough risks. He says we need to have a higher cancel rate overall. And so that's one leader who does a very good job of learning from a success. And I think that's why, partially at least, why Netflix has been so successful.
Businesses of all shapes and sizes are under threat right now. Do you think this threat, the COVID-19 threat, will actually make us better at thinking because we have to?
That's certainly my hope. We have been forced out of the status quo, whether we like it or not. And then the question becomes, when the world returns to some semblance of normalcy, do we just go back to what we were doing before? Or do we unlearn what we know and build a better tomorrow? And I think the businesses who are able to, and leaders who are able to redefine themselves, who can unlearn what they know, get rid of these outdated assumptions, and build themselves back up from scratch, will be the ones that will be able to define the future. And I am optimistic, although there was a part of me that also thinks that, you know, I've seen a lot of articles. The famous example is from Isaac Newton, who came up with all of these breakthrough revolutionary ideas during the Great Plague. But, you know, Isaac Newton didn't have Netflix. Isaac Newton didn't have Facebook and Instagram. He could actually take the time to think through his ideas and generate these breakthroughs. But to go back to what we were talking about before, and anecdotally speaking, what I'm seeing around me is that digital consumption hasn't decreased during the pandemic. If anything, it has increased. We are glued to our phones, to news websites, more than ever before. And I think for us to be able to come up with creative solutions to detach ourselves from the baggage of history, we need to create those moments of slack and actually distance ourselves from consumption of knowledge. Sometimes can get in the way of generating breakthroughs. And so abandoning news websites for a while, you know, one of the really great things that I've done for my own creativity is decreasing my news consumption. I'll scan the headlines in the morning, but I don't do much more than that. And that's been great for my sanity, but it's also been great for my creativity, because I can tune into sort of what's within me internally, and allow my brain to make those connections and generate creative ideas, which are not possible if you're glued to your phone all day and looking for that one article that's going to assuage your fears or anxiety. We're looking for certainty too. That's another thing that I'm seeing in the world around me, which is so normal. I mean, uncertainty and the unknown is so frightening to humans. And so we're looking for predictions and forecasts about what tomorrow is going to look like and when the lockdown is going to end. And we spend a lot of time trying to control what cannot be controlled. So I think it's far more productive and far more useful to ask ourselves, what is actually within my control? What is it that I can do? How can I solve the problems that the world needs solving right now, as opposed to the problems that I expect it to solve? So asking those productive questions is going to generate much better results than, you know, than tugging at a plant to make it grow faster, which is a futile exercise.
Thank you so much for talking to us on Bokomi today. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, Richard. Thank you so much for having me on.
Ozan Varol's book, Think Like a Rocket Scientist, Simple Strategies You Can Use to Make Giant Leaps in Work and Life, is available via the link in our podcast description. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction across business, science, culture and current affairs, sign up to our monthly Most Wanted email at bokomi.com. From July, Bokomi members can take part in our podcast recordings and companies can co-host their own audio and video events with authors on our monthly Most Wanted lists. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bokomi podcast, please reveal your feelings by liking, following or subscribing on Apple, Spotify and Google audio platforms, or any other platform as many exist. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Be good, be smart, be there for each other. Bye for now.